This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes. The president seeking America's undivided attention on health care.
This is 1/6 of our economy. I think that we can build on what works, fix what's broken, and still save substantial money.
But a secret Republican-inspired plan disrupts the national town meeting.
Let me first of all apologize to my wife, Jenny, and our great boys, Marshall, Landon, Bolton, and Blake, for letting them down.
South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford's situation tragedy unfolds comically yesterday and captures the front pages. Trips to Argentina, an affair, scandalous emails, derailing the healthcare debate was probably not the point. Poor Obama, trying to stay on message and away from a governor's mess. Messed up at The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, June 25th. I'm John Hockenberry, and this morning we're trying to stay on message, at least for this hour. We're talking about health care, and we'll bring you up to date on all the details of Mark Sanford's controversy, which unfolded yesterday. We'll also get the latest on the contested election in Iran. Less than a third of the country's members of parliament showed up for Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's victory party last night. And we'll talk health care with another governor, Michigan's Jennifer Granholm. More on all of this coming up, but first, some headlines. Was Bank of America's purchase of Merrill Lynch a shotgun wedding type of affair? House lawmakers are expected to ask that of Fed Chair Ben Bernanke today when he goes to the Hill to discuss the acquisition. The top U.S. general in Afghanistan says international troops need to majorly shift how they approach civilian casualties. General Stanley McChrystal says troops must stop firing at insurgents if civilians are present. In Iran, President Ahmadinejad is telling President Obama to keep out of Iranian affairs. President Obama said earlier this week that he was shocked by the government's suppression of protests in Iran. Meanwhile, Iran's main opposition candidate, Mir Hussein Mousavi, says on his website that his access to the Iranian people is suddenly being tightly restricted. The Washington, D.C. subway is reopening all the stations along its red line for the morning and evening rush hours today. A fatal crash occurred on that line earlier this week. It was the worst in the Washington metro system's history. Meanwhile, Washington Mayor Adrian Fenty says the crash highlights the need to modernize the city's subway cars. Some fresh economic data expected out later this hour. We'll learn the Commerce Department's new estimate for GDP growth in the first quarter, and we'll get new jobless claims numbers for last week. On Wall Street yesterday, trading was a bit erratic. The S&P rose 0.7% to close at 901. The Dow fell 3% to close at 8,300. And the NASDAQ rose 1.6% to close at 1792. And a flat opening is predicted by the futures trading on Wall Street this morning when the Wall Street trading opens in about 90 minutes from now. It's our Governor's Hall of Fame. We want to give an award for the worst governor of all time. With Mark Sanford's difficulties in South Carolina, I mean, we are asking the question, what goes with governors? Let us know. Nominate any state you want.
Hello, this is Marianne from Rhode Island, nominating Edward Dupree of Rhode Island, who not only was sent to jail on corruption charges, then as soon as he got out, there was a long, long battle to claim his state pension. Thank you.
What's the deal with governors? Tell us at 877-MY-TAKE. Nominate by email at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. After watching President Obama speaking last night on ABC News talking about health care to a town meeting assembled by the network, it's fairly clear that the Obama approach to health care reform is very different than the Clinton administration's approach back in the 90s. The president last night was very upfront about costs.
We will have some upfront costs. And the estimates, as Charlie has said, have been anywhere from $1 trillion to $2 trillion. But what we've said is, what my administration has said, what I've said, is that Whatever it is that we do, we pay for.
And what the president is looking for is the political will to spend $2 trillion, as much as $2 trillion, on health care reform.
What's lacking is not knowledge. We've been debating this stuff for decades. What's lacking is political will. Genuine change generally does not come from Washington. Whether we like it or not, it comes from the American people saying it's time for us to move forward. And I think this is that moment.
So instead of putting together a think tank of policy experts, as the Clinton administration did back in the 90s, Obama seems to be leading with that political will, leading with the American people. Congress is handling the policy details, and Obama is kind of coaching from the sidelines, saying that there's going to be change, folks, but it isn't going to be too radical.
For us to completely change our system, root and branch, would be hugely disruptive, and I think would end up resulting in people having to completely change their doctors, their health care providers, in a way that I'm not prepared to go.
Well, where are the American people prepared to go on health care reform? We're going to talk with some folks that we've been speaking with over the last few weeks as we look at the health care reform debate from a number of angles. Dr. Peter Ubel, physician and behavioral scientist, joins us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. His latest book is Free Market Madness, Why Human Nature is at Odds with Economics and Why It Matters. Peter, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks.
Dr. Moitri Savard is a family physician with a private practice in Queens, New York. She joins us from Long Island City. Dr. Savard, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Noreen Thompson runs a 13-room hotel with her husband in Eastham, Massachusetts. She has all kinds of issues with health care. We haven't spoken to you before, so welcome to the program, Noreen.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Ubel, do you think this approach, from the perspective of a behavioral scientist, of letting the American people lead the debate and the policy issues be worked out in Congress rather than by assembling a team of experts, as the Clinton administration did, do you think this approach is more likely to succeed?
I think it is more likely to succeed, and I think Obama has the right diagnosis. He knows the costs are out of control, that what we pay for in medicine is very strange system of paying people to do too much to their patients. And so he's got the right diagnosis. The treatment, I think we have a lot of details we need to learn about what treatment they're going to have to the system.
And Dr. Savard, did you hear anything last night that made you particularly excited about either adopting the kinds of practices that you spoke with us on the program about a few weeks ago, or things that would make your job easier?
Sure. I like that he talked about a health insurance exchange. I think one of the problems my patients have is finding health insurance that they can afford. So if they're given a menu of all their different options, I think that would be very helpful.
And Noreen Thompson, what are your sort of headaches regarding health care, maintaining a health care plan for yourself? And I'm presuming that there is conceivably an issue with your employees.
Well, employees, no, because we only employ employees in the summertime, so it's not a big issue there, because we actually stay away from hiring employees that are going to need health insurance, and for that reason, we can't afford the insurance for our family, let alone for employees as well. A lot of the biggest problem with us is cost, and the fact that we're changing insurances just about every year, every other year. I have more insurance cards than Carter has liver pills, I really do. So,
did you hear anything last night that made you feel as though perhaps change is coming and you're not going to be bouncing around like this indefinitely?
No, not necessarily. I did and I didn't. I mean, I think maybe the approach might be better for getting something done, but I don't necessarily think it's the approach that we really need at this point. I think I am firmly committed to single-payer health care. I think that's the way to go. And I think that having supplemental plans to go along with single-payer health plans would be fine, and that would probably be a better way to go than to try it this way. But we'll see.
Dr. Ubel, is a health care reform plan going to have specific caps that consumers are going to be able to be aware of, or is it going to vary from treatment to treatment, drug to drug, and constantly be a moving target as auditors take a look at what's working and what doesn't work?
I think you can count on this to be hard to know what you're going to get. I think it's the biggest challenge Obama faces is how to control health care costs. And that is going to be a political challenge, because everyone who's making money in the health care system are going to fight any plan that would reduce how much money they make And it's also going to be a big challenge to consumers, to Americans, because we're not going to know what barriers they're going to put for patients to get what they want out of the healthcare system.
Dr. Savard, we spoke yesterday with someone who was giving us some insights into the German plan, the way Germany operates. And they have private insurers in Germany, but they have a very strict set of regulations as to how to behave and what sorts of costs are permissible within the system. If there was a rigorous set of new federal mandates on how to practice and what to pay for various kinds of procedures, would that be onerous for you?
It depends how it was administered, but I could see it being difficult. I mean, I do agree that the biggest problem is going to be cost control. When asked about his family last night, President Obama said, yes, of course, he would want everything done, but he was hoping that there would be some, you know, evidence behind that. But the problem is, when it comes to your family members, no amount of evidence really makes a difference sometimes. I mean, he talked about... I think he didn't actually refer to it, but Atul Gawande had an article in The New Yorker where he talked about the healthcare system in McAllen, Texas. Now, as part of that article, he admitted that he had a son who had had a bad fall, and he insisted that his child have an extra ICU stay, even though it wouldn't have necessarily improved his outcome, he found out later. But the problem is, when it's your child and there's a 1%, 2% chance, even though the evidence isn't necessarily there, sometimes that's what you want done. And that's, I think, going to be a huge problem. So I don't quite know, with a system like Germany, how something like that is going to be administered and who's going to make the final decision of, no, it can't be done.
Well, Dr. Hubel, the Atul Gawande article that we've actually focused on this program before focuses on the Southern Minnesota system at the Mayo Clinic. And they're very disciplined at the Mayo Clinic. If you ask for something and they say it's not appropriate, you just don't get it, period, the end. Can the federal government adopt that kind of discipline on a national scale and basically do what Mayo does?
No.
Really?
It's very hard to replicate the Mayo Clinic. I trained there. It's a wonderful place. It's a place where if they think you need something, they will get it for you, often cheaper than other places. So it's not just that they do less. They also charge less. They have, their doctors at Mayo are on salary. Most doctors in the United States aren't salaried, and they would resist being put on a salary, even if that was the best thing for the country.
Noreen, in Easton, Massachusetts, do you have good healthcare providers there, even though it's expensive and confusing for you to maintain insurance?
It's a big problem here. We're losing doctors, and it's really hard to stay with one family physician. We had one for a few years, and then they ended up putting her on walk-ins. And I've bounced around for a number of times since then. I've got one that I've had for like over a year, and I'm crossing my fingers, but it's a problem.
So even if you wanted to maintain a primary care physician, engage in all kinds of preventive health care, to pay up front for preventive procedures that are going to pay off down the line, you can't even do it because there's nobody there to provide you with that service.
There aren't enough family physicians. There aren't enough, you know, it is a big problem. I think there's plenty of specialists. And I think that was one of the things that was raised last night, was being a specialist is more lucrative and helps to pay for medical students,
right,
to pay off their bills much easier. But, yeah, we've got a big problem with family physicians.
All right, well, we're going to come back to you, Noreen. Dr. Moitri Savard, we're going to give you the last word here. Any sign from the town meeting last night that a proliferation of primary care physicians such as yourself are going to hit the beach anytime soon? We just have a few seconds.
Yes, I mean, he did mention it as his, I believe it was number three on his plan, is the promotion of primary care. And he did speak to that medical student who had $300,000 in debt who really wants to go into primary care.
Well, that's positive. Dr. Moitri Savard, family physician with a private practice in Queens. Let's hope there are more doctors like you. And Dr. Peter Hubel, physician and behavioral scientist, and also Noreen Thompson. Thanks so much to all of you folks. And nominate a governor, won't you?
My name is Ciro, and I have two nominations. First is dead Governor Bill Clinton, whose nickname used to be Slick Willie, among other things. And actually, I'd also like to nominate state police in those states who are supposed to be guarding these governors and who look the other way when they're doing all of these extracurricular, extramarital things.
Thanks for that suggestion. But widen your horizons. There are a lot of governors with a lot of very interesting character traits. Nominate one for our Hall of Fame on The Takeaway, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Well, we can speculate on the motives of South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, who resurfaced yesterday. And it reminds us that governors in America are a specific class, a special class of politicians. We actually want to create a Governor's Hall of Fame this morning. We want you to give an award for the worst or most colorful or most entertaining governor of all time. You can go as far back in history as you like, but you got to compete with the likes of Eliot Spitzer, Rod Blagojevich, and, of course, Mark Sanford, the governor of the moment. Nominate any governor from any state you want. Tell us why your pick should win. We'll tally the votes and update you throughout the morning. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And it's the case of that missing governor from South Carolina.
I hurt her. I hurt you all. I hurt my wife. I hurt my boys. I hurt friends like Tom Davis. I hurt a lot of different folks. And all I can say is that I apologize.
If that's all he did say yesterday at his news conference, maybe it would be better for South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford. We could only speculate as to what was going on when we spoke with Yvonne Wenger yesterday, reporter for South Carolina Post and Courier in Columbia, South Carolina. Yvonne, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Lots happened in the last 24 hours, eh?
Oh, my goodness. Yes. I guess we never thought we'd hear Governor Sanford's name mentioned with the likes of Eliot Spitzer and Rod Blagojevich.
Well, I was sort of hinting that maybe we were going in that direction yesterday, but I had no idea what I was talking about, which is sort of the branding of this show. Mm. Yvonne, how are people in South Carolina, first of all, reacting to what's happened?
The reaction is really all over the map. There are people who are real angry, upset. They feel deceived and betrayed. And there's at least one state lawmaker that's calling for the governor to resign. And you know, we've received huge reaction on our website. The story yesterday generated about 600 comments. A typical controversial story would generate about 100. So people are really passionate about this subject.
And let's listen to Mark Sanford yesterday trying to explain and deliver the details to the voters in the state of South Carolina and the rest of us.
I've been unfaithful to my wife. I developed a relationship with what started as a dear, dear friend from Argentina. It began very innocently, as I suspect many of these things do, in just a casual email back and forth, in advice on one's life there and advice here. But here recently, over this last year, it developed into something much more than that.
So, Yvonne, the emails are at the center of this story all of a sudden, and it's a bit of a newspaper war there in South Carolina. Can you explain what the information is that seems to be leaking out in public and how you can verify it?
Yeah, unfortunately, these emails were delivered to the state newspaper, our competitor, by an anonymous tipster, as I understand. Some members of their newsroom received the emails as early as December.
Wow.
Yeah. But they were unable to verify, and there were just too many questions to responsibly put this information out there at that time. But as I understand, the reporters at the paper were able to get the governor's office to, if not verify, not dispute that these were legitimate emails that had come from the governor's private email account.
And one of the things that really comes out as kind of a backstory here, Yvonne, and I wonder if you could comment on it, Mark Sanford, an apparent rising star in the Republican Party, certainly a powerful politician in your state, expressed open frustrations with the limitations of being governor, There were apparently some longstanding problems in his own family that, you know, preceded this particular trip to Argentina. Mm. And he didn't seem to be terribly happy with the most powerful job in the state.
Yeah, Governor's constantly been frustrated with the limitations of his role as governor. Our Constitution, which was drafted in 1895, purposely leaves the executive branch with very little power. The state Senate is very powerful in our state, and the governor has and made the general theme of his second term, first term, trying to get more power. So yeah, I would say he's been very dissatisfied with the responsibility and authority of the position.
And what do South Carolinians think of that? It sort of, you know, did he not live up to his responsibilities? And is there a constitutional issue with him being gone and not telling anybody? He even left his cell phone back in the United States so that it was impossible to reach him.
Our Senate President Pro Tem Glenn McConnell, who's a Republican from Charleston, is planning to introduce some legislation to clear up some questions that have arisen with the line of power in the state. You know, if there had been an emergency and the governor was out of touch, it's pretty clear if it had been a true emergency that the lieutenant governor would be able to step up without doubt. But there are a lot of questions that the lawmakers are going to try to be answering when they return in January.
Well, so far, the question of him being governor hasn't really been raised except in the abstract. I suppose you can imagine a statement that he is stepping down because he wants to spend less time with his family. That might be the statement if he were to resign this morning. But there's no talk of that. I'm going to put you on the spot, Yvonne. Mark Sanford, in your book, Worst Governor of All Time, you want to nominate someone?
I definitely wouldn't say he's the worst governor of all time. He, you just see the man yesterday standing very vulnerably before probably about 100 members of the media, holding back tears a lot of times. And, I mean, you know, he got caught, and so did he deserve it? I don't know. But it was pretty
dramatic.
Sad. Yeah, dramatic.
Yeah, yeah, I would say.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Yvonne Wenger, reporter for the South Carolina Post and Courier, joins us from Columbia, South Carolina. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Richard Hake has our headlines.
And John, good morning. In Iran, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is telling the president, President Obama, to stop interfering in Iranian affairs. Earlier this week, President Obama strongly condemned what he called the unjust violence used against protesters. Iran's main opposition leader, Mir Hossein Mousavi, says on his website that his access to the Iranian people is being tightly restricted. He also said that he had been pressured to withdraw his challenge to the election results. On Capitol Hill today, lawmakers will be trying to find out if Bank of America's purchase of Merrill Lynch happened too quickly. House lawmakers are expected to ask that of the Fed Chair Ben Bernanke today when he goes to the Hill to discuss the acquisition. The Washington, D.C. subway is reopening all the stations along its red line for the morning and evening rush hours today. A fatal crash occurred on that line earlier this week. The mayor there says the crash highlights the need to modernize the city's subway cars. And researchers say one of Saturn's moons may be the best place to try to find life outside Earth. They believe there's an ocean under the icy surface similar to ours.
Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Call them colorful, call them memorable, call them scandalous. But what is it about governors? Mark Sanford of South Carolina now joins the ranks of Elliot Spitzer, Rod Blagojevich. Nominate any governor from any state you want. And we're putting together a worst governor of all time, a governor's hall of fame. All right. Tell us your pick and why they should win.
Elliot Spitzer goes down as the worst, especially now, because if he wasn't out, that New York State Senate mess wouldn't exist today because they'd have a presiding officer.
877-8-MY-TAKE for your nomination. That's one for Elliot Spitzer. You can also go to our website at mytake@thetakeaway.org. So we shift our focus now to the developing situation in Iran. 13 days now since the disputed election that showed a landslide win for President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Demonstrations by supporters of opposition candidate Mir Hussein Mousavi now seem to be turning into splintered acts of rage, but they are continuing. Witnesses say security forces yesterday beat protesters with batons and fired rounds of ammunition into the air. Iran's supreme leader is still insisting that the government will not yield to pressure. Joining us now from Cairo is Michael Slackman, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. He's writing today about the continuing unrest in Iran, but how it's rippling through the Arab world. Michael Slackman in Cairo, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
So, you know, there's clearly a divide between the Farsi-speaking Iranian people, predominantly Shiite, and the Arab world, which is predominantly Sunni. There's a rivalry that's, you know, longstanding in historical terms. How are people in the Arab world viewing what's going on in Iran?
Well, there's two ways to look at it. One is on the street, and the other is in the halls of power among the leaders. On the street, it's seen as kind of a distant conflict. There's not the same kind of empathy or emotional connection between the Arab street and Iran and the Arab street and, say, the Palestinian conflict. On some levels, there's also a degree of confusion because Ahmadinejad was widely admired throughout the Arab public because of his defiant posture to the West and his aggressive tone toward Israel. So I think initially there was a little bit of confusion and uncertainty when they saw all these people rising up, taking to the streets. There's a natural empathy for the people who are protesting, but there's also a sympathy for Ahmadinejad, so there was a little bit of confusion. On the level of the leaders, it splits between those countries like Syria that had been aligned with Iran and other countries aligned with the West, like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan. As for the American-aligned countries, they're pretty pleased at what they're seeing happen, but they're also cautious. They're not sure how it's going to turn out, so they're staying quiet.
I'm wondering if this is a holdover from the 1980s, where Ronald Reagan famously wanted no winner in the brutal Iran-Iraq war. Keeping both of those nations off base seemed to benefit not only the Americans, but also the Saudis and other Arab players, even Israel. Is Iran off base or off balance? An advantage in any concrete policy terms?
Well, I don't know that the United States would see it that way now. I think the United States would probably say a stable, open, and internationally integrated Iran is probably better than an off, you know, kind of a shaky, problematic Iran led by hardliners and extremists. So I'm not sure the U.S. would say that, but certainly the Arab allies of the United States in the Middle East who are concerned about Iran becoming the regional economic, political, and social superpower here, they see that as an advantage, absolutely. To see Iran kind of caught between its own conflict, focused internally, and not becoming involved in the events in the region that they think are their purview.
Well, from the perspective of the Arab world, this is really the first misstep and kind of stumble of the Iranians since 2003, where policymakers all over the world and to some frustration in Washington watched Iran's profile rise as the U.S. occupation became bogged down in Iraq. The Iranians seem to be the main beneficiary of everything that happened post 9/11. Now they've stumbled.
Yeah, that's very true. I think that's from the perspective here, that's absolutely what has happened. Iran benefited from the Taliban disappearing in Afghanistan. They benefited from the events in Iraq when Saddam was taken out and the Shiites came to power who were more sympathetic and more connected with Iran. All throughout the region, the wars between Hezbollah, which are allied with Iran, and Israel, the Hamas taking over in the Gaza Strip, Hamas is aligned with Iran as well, seemed to err on the side of Iran. What the Arab states that are aligned with the United States are saying is this is the first time in quite a while, where they feel they have the opportunity to regain momentum now. Mm. The question is, what cards do they really have in terms of leverage? You know, the leadership in Cairo and the leadership in Riyadh have seen their influence diminish considerably.
Now, finally, are there some constraints in the Arab world in the sense that if they wanted to manipulate in Iran by explicitly supporting the demonstrators, they would suddenly have to answer to their own people who maybe have plenty of reason to demonstrate on their own?
Well, I don't think anybody here, like in Egypt or Syria or Saudi Arabia, is seriously concerned about mass protests taking to the streets. Egypt effectively functions on a security level as a police state. They maintain tremendous control here. Culturally, it's quite different. There's a lot of civil life, civil society in Iran. There's a history there. 30 years ago, they had a revolution. In Egypt, the civil society is quite limited. Same thing in Saudi Arabia. So I don't think anybody here is really concerned about people taking a lesson from the protests over in Iran.
Yet you don't see the governments explicitly endorsing the protesters in Iran, even though they might endorse instability there.
Well, the governments are being very quiet about this, absolutely. The leaders are kind of holding their breath. That's what some analysts in the region told me yesterday. They think it's too good to be true. They don't want to jinx it. They don't want to be accused of pushing things in the wrong direction. But if you take a look at the state-controlled media, it's almost amusing in the way they talk about things like human rights and protecting democracy in Iran.
That's a great sum up. Michael Slackman is the Cairo bureau chief for our partners, the New York Times. He spoke with us from Cairo, Egypt. Thanks, Michael. And, you know, the governors in the United States are a very special crew. Nominate one for our Governor's Hall of Fame in light of what's been going on with Mark Sanford. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And Richard Hake has some headlines here.
And we do. Just out two big economic indicators. The Labor Department says new jobless claims were up unexpectedly last week. The number of people who applied for unemployment benefits rose to 627,000. And the U.S. economy shrank less in the first quarter of this year than the Commerce Department initially reported. That's because businesses did not cut inventory as much as previously thought. The Republican Party is moving on after South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford went AWOL this weekend. He was in Argentina with his mistress. It's been announced that Governor Haley Barbour will take over as chairman of the Republican Governors Association. Sanford stepped down from the post yesterday.
It was a trade trip, right? They might want to import mistresses from Argentina.
Is that what's going on?
It's an economic development thing.
Okay, yeah. Well,
get to that Afghanistan story. That's actually really important.
Yeah, the top U.S. general in Afghanistan says international troops need to majorly shift how they approach civilian casualties. The general, Stanley McChrystal, says troops must stop firing at insurgents if civilians are present.
Thank you, Richard.
Oh, you're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The Obama administration said yesterday that it will appoint an ambassador to Syria. Here's Robert Gibbs.
This strongly reflects the administration's recognition of the role Syria plays and the hope of the role that the Syrian government can play constructively to promote peace and stability in the region.
Well, let's test that assumption of White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs, shall we? The Bush administration yanked its ambassador to Syria back in 2005 after the assassination of Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. Some say yesterday's announcement indicates just how much the Obama administration wants Syria to help in the Middle East, especially with the Arab-Israeli conflict. Andrew Tabler joins us from Washington, D.C. He's a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and he focuses on Syria. Andrew, thanks for being with us. And does Syria make things easier for the Obama administration? Is it sort of a sidetrack that could develop some regional momentum?
Well, the idea is that placing an ambassador in Damascus will help facilitate American diplomacy. It is not necessarily so much on the peace track between Israel and Syria, which is stalled at the moment, and we're not sure if and when that would get up and functioning, but more to deal with a long list of bilateral issues between Syria and the United States, which have developed over the last 5 years, including expanding nuclear file, the issue of the Lebanese border, foreign fighters going in from Syria into Iraq, which have been extensive over the last 5-6 years, and also their human rights record, which continues to get worse and worse. So Washington's rationale is having a diplomat there, a chief of mission, will allow that to happen more easily, and we'll see how it goes.
Well, what do you think? Does the U.S. have leverage, and can it offer enough in the way of satisfying these bilateral issues to make some of the regional ones, come forth?
It's going to be a long, hot summer. The files between Syria and the United States are extensive, and especially the nuclear issue is extremely big. It's getting worse. They found more particles at their research reactor during the last IAEA's Board of Governors meeting. The Lebanese issue remains outstanding. I think people are hopeful, but the issue also of foreign fighters going into Iraq, it's very hard to measure that and to be able to see what Syria is doing on their side to clamp down on that kind of activity. So it'd be very interesting.
I mean, you would have to say, though, at the very least, these issues are all easier with an actual ambassador in place as opposed to being in a kind of a deep freeze since 2005.
That's right. Having an ambassador in Damascus in one way makes it easier in that you can deal directly with Syria and you can speak very honestly with Syria and not have to go through an intermediary like the French or other European countries. So that's good. The question is, do you put the hard questions? This is the hard part. You have to put the hard questions to Damascus and try and get some explanations for worsening behavior on that front.
And there's a number of individuals in the region. I mean, will the ambassador be the one with the hard questions, or will it be George Mitchell, the Obama administration's Middle East envoy? Andrew Tabler, SORF fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, we thank you for that update. And governors, it turns out, are a rich source of character or character flaws, depending on how you look at it. Nominate one of the governors down through history, or one of the current governors, in our Governor Hall of Shame, I guess it's fair to say. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Good morning. My name is Zoe, and I'm calling from Belleville, New Jersey. I'd like to nominate former Governor Christine Todd Whitman. Not only did she spend on our surplus and leave our state indebted, she began racial profiling and participated in that terrible act that just teared down our state police system.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. So Governor of South Carolina Mark Sanford vanishes, and he turns up from Argentina where he had an affair. He confesses. Oh, my goodness. What's going on with governors? Nominate one for our Governor's Hall of Shame. Go as far back in history as you want, but you got to compete with Eliot Spitzer, Mark Sanford, Blagojevich. Nominate anyone. Why should your pick win?
Hi, my name is Kirk, and I'm calling from Boston. And I'd like to nominate Governor Edwards of Louisiana. He was tried 3 times by the federal government before finally convicted after they were able to sneak a wiretap in his office for numerous crimes.
877-8-MY-TAKE for your nominations, or send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm nominating Richard Hake.
Oh, thank you.
For the headlines.
Headlines. All right, good.
You're welcome.
Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke goes before a House committee today to face questions about the Fed's role in the Bank of America's purchase of Merrill Lynch. Washington Mayor Adrian Fenty says the fatal crash that occurred earlier this week highlights the need to modernize the city's subway cars.
It's pretty clear we have to make some changes. It's pretty clear we've got to get rid of some of these cars that are not as quote-unquote crash-worthy as they need to be. They get into an accident, they need to be a little bit more durable, protect the riders better.
The Washington, D.C. subway system is reopening all the stations along its red line for the morning and evening rush hours today. The fatal crash occurred on that line earlier this week. There's been several more deadly bombings today in Iraq. Iraqi police say an explosion at a Baghdad bus station left 7 people dead. Meanwhile, 3 other separate bombings left 2 people dead. These are the most recent in a series of bombings that have plagued the country in a week before the U.S. military is expected to withdraw from Iraqi cities. At the White House today, the president hosts a bipartisan meeting on immigration reform with lawmakers. The White House says the meeting will launch a policy conversation, something it hopes will be debated formally later this year. And you might see some Lays and grass skirts at the White House tonight. Yes, the President and First Lady will host a luau on the South Lawn for members of Congress and their families. So, John, break out your Hawaiian shirt.
And that's Michelle Obama playing the ukulele?
That is her, yeah.
Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
So the good side and bad side of governors coming up. I mean, if you've been living under a rock for the past 24 hours, you may not know what happened to South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford. He was, of course, completely AWOL for about 4 days. Then there were some rumors he'd gone hiking along the Appalachian Trail, but some reporters ran into him at the airport coming back from Argentina. And in Argentina, the story told by the governor was that he was engaged in an extramarital affair with someone he met, and then through sending emails, it became something else. Here's Governor Mark Sanford in a news conference just yesterday afternoon.
I've let down a lot of people. That's the bottom line. And I let them down, and in every instance, I would ask their forgiveness. Forgiveness is not an immediate process. It is, in fact, a process that takes time, and I'll be in that process for quite some weeks and months, and I suspect years ahead.
Well, the resurrection of Mark Sanford, even before his huge fall from grace, is even absorbed by voters in the state of South Carolina, is certainly the focus today. And, of course, Mark Sanford joins a pantheon of governors who are either the object of scandal or certainly colorful, eccentric characters. What is it about governors? Here's just a small sample.
I'm glad this process has finally begun.
I've been unfaithful to my wife.
It was wrong. It was foolish. It was inexcusable.
I've acted in a way that violates my obligations to my family and that violates my or any sense of right and wrong.
Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich there. Of course, Mark Sanford speaking yesterday. James McGreevy in New Jersey and Elliot Spitzer in New York. We are thinking about, informally, a Governor's Hall of Fame on The Takeaway this morning. Give us your nomination at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. And this morning we want to talk to a governor who is not involved in any sort of problem like this. Joining us, we are thrilled to have Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm on the phone from Michigan, who we're speaking with because she met with Barack Obama yesterday on the issue of health care, the issue that got a little bit buried in the Sanford coverage. But first of all, Governor Granholm, thanks so much for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having me on.
How was the meeting with the president yesterday? I mean, what are his concerns? There's really a collaborative mission there between Washington and state houses on the whole issue of health care reform.
Well, the governors are the ones who see it happen on the ground, who implement Medicaid, who have to deal with the costs of Medicare. And so the president met with a bipartisan group of governors, part of a group of 9 governors who hosted regional health care forums around the country in March and in April. And so we wanted to go and share with him what we learned from not just the forums, but as our experience as governors. There's just so much, you know, I know you hear a lot about what's going on in D.C. and the Republicans and the Democrats and they're at odds. You know, the governors, we're very pragmatic, and we have a whole array of things that we all agree on. And so we really went to underscore the importance of urgency and of making sure our voices are in the mix, because we really want to see health care reform, and we want it now because it affects the economy as well.
Well, Governor, let's break out some of those issues, because I want people to understand firmly what the centers of power and policy are in state houses. So let's take the concerns about costs for Medicare and Medicaid. What is the chance that this whole reform process is going to saddle states like Michigan with mandates they can't afford?
afford right at a time when their fiscal house is so rickety to begin with.
Well, that was certainly one of the things that we wanted to bring to make sure that he is committed to not putting more costs on the states. Of course, the states have to balance their budgets. We don't have the luxury of what's happening in Washington. And so as we go through this reform transition, reform is not going to happen overnight. We want to make sure that if they expand populations, for example, of people who are eligible for health care, that they don't put that whole burden on the backs of states, which are having to lay people off, having to cut police and fire, having to cut lots of things to
right.
make sure that we balance. So that was one of the things we certainly all agree on, and I think that's going to be part of, I believe very strongly, that will be part of both the House and the Senate versions.
Well, Michigan is in a special category, and far be it from me to say that a 14.1% unemployment rate in Michigan is any kind of a policy opportunity, but many have described that one of the obstacles to health care reform is that people tend to stay with their coverage. In Michigan, with the enormous numbers of unemployed and rising uninsured, does the state have an opportunity to sweep up these uninsured with proper resources from the federal government and really take a stab at making a statewide state pool of insured to deliver health care reform?
Well, absolutely. We're really, if you think about it, we're the poster child for why this has to happen now. I mean, the reason why our economy is in such a difficult position is because of the auto industry. The auto industry's had to compete with companies in countries where they provide health care. Last year, before the auto meltdown, there were more cars that were being built in Ontario, Canada, than in Michigan for the first time.
Wow.
And they were going there, those auto companies, because health care is provided. So if you're going to compete on a global playing field, you have to make sure that our job providers get some relief on this and not put the entire burden on the back of business. That's one reason why we are in this fix. And the other thing is we have a, you know, it's sort of a morbid, I don't want to say joke, but we have a saying that the auto companies are really healthcare companies
right.
who make cars to pay for it.
Exactly.
So that's, you know, we don't want to see other companies or other states go through what Michigan's going through. So we could be the example of why this is so important and why it's so important right now.
Well,
yes, there is an opportunity to provide larger degree of coverage. Maybe you have skinnied down benefits, but what you really want to do is give people, if they've got good health care, you want to allow them to have the choice of keeping that. But there's so much
sure.
waste in
well,
the system right now.
Let me just ask you one quick question, and under like 15, 20 seconds here, really, because we got to go.
Okay.
You can actually pool your resources and make things cheaper at the state level. Give me one example of how you've done that, and then we really do have to go.
Yep, really quickly. Economies of scale, very important. We've done the same thing with prescription drugs, significantly reduced the cost for those who want in the state government, in our state employees, as well as senior citizens. We can do that across the country.
Great lessons. Buying in bulk from Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm, contributing to the national debate on health care. Thanks so much for joining us. We're always on at The Takeaway. If you missed anything like that interview with the Michigan governor, take our podcast to go. You can subscribe at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. And you can see images on our website of Iranians around the world holding marches of their own. We have a slideshow of the demonstrations on thetakeaway.org. So it's not necessarily Jennifer Granholm, but we're also looking for nominees to our Governor's Hall of Shame. We want you to give an award for the worst governor of all time. Granholm's not in there, of course, but you could think of Rod Blagojevich. Haven't had a nomination for him yet. How about your state?
Hi, my name is Charles. I'm calling from Scarsdale, New York. In terms of the worst governor, you have to look at a guy named Evan Mecham, who was the governor of Arizona in the late 1980s. I would nominate him because he's the only governor in American history who ever faced simultaneous impeachment, indictment, and a recall election.
Not bad. Martha emails us, George W. Bush allowed execution after execution in Texas and made fun of Carla Rae Tucker before her execution. Tell us your nomination at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
In her darkest hour, America turns once again to a governor.
So the bottom line is this. I've been unfaithful to my wife. I developed a relationship with a, which started as a dear, dear friend from Argentina. It began very innocently, as I suspect many of these things do, in just a casual email.
South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford reappears after a trip to Argentina and describes an extramarital affair, his frustrations with being governor, and how arguing over federal stimulus money drove him to exhaustion.
I'm a bottom line kind of guy. I'll lay it out. It's going to hurt. And we'll let the chips fall where they may.
Hitting bottom, what is it about governors in America? Move over, Blagojevich and Spitzer. There's a new man in town. There's your takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, June 25th. I'm John Hockenberry. Besides the Sanford saga, there's a backstory at the Federal Reserve, and it involves Ben Bernanke and the Bank of America Merrill Lynch deal. And 25 years ago, Prince released Purple Rain, the album and the movie. The Syrian sideshow in the Middle East politics and more global models for American health care reform. All this and everything you need to know today. But Gail Collins, I can hear you there, columnist for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning. And quickly, what is it about governors?
I'm beginning to think they don't have enough to do. We haven't talked much about that, but many of them don't really have much power. So maybe they've got a lot of time on their hands that we haven't really appreciated until now.
You know, you wrote a column last week about another rising star succumbing to an extramarital affair in the Republican Party, and you noted that everyone in the Republican Party is a presidential candidate. Here goes another one biting the dust.
He was sort of a medium-sized or tadpole-sized one. He had been considered for vice president last time around. So I think this is a pretty medium-sized, good-sized catch here.
Well, more on the medium-sized, tadpole-sized catch with Gail Collins. But first, these headlines so you can know everything you need to know today. In Iran, opposition leader Mir Hussein Mousavi is making accusations over the recent bloodshed in that country. He says those who, quote, rigged the vote are responsible, and he's encouraging opposition supporters to continue their protests. Washington, D.C. subway system is reopening to all stations along its red line for the morning and evening rush hours today. The fatal crash occurred on that line earlier this week. It was the worst in the metro's history. New economic data to chew on today. The Commerce Department has revised its GDP estimate for the first quarter. The economy shrank 5.5%, slightly less than previously reported. Meanwhile, the number of people filing new jobless claims jumped unexpectedly last week to 627,000. The S&P rose 0.7%. It begins trading at 9:01 today. Worst governor of all time? Nominate somebody, won't you?
Kelly Spitzer goes down as the worst, especially now, because if he wasn't out, that New York State Senate mess wouldn't exist today because they'd have a presiding officer.
Worst governor of all time, it's a high, high bar. More on the Sanford crisis coming up. But give us a nomination at 8778-MYTAKE or email mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. First, we've already had nominations for worst governor of all time. Eliot Spitzer, Evan Meacham of Arizona. And here's another nominee.
Hello, this is Marianne from Rhode Island nominating Edward DePreet of Rhode Island, who not only was sent to jail on corruption charges, then as soon as he got out, there was a long, long battle to claim his state pension. Thank you.
What is it about governors? It's kind of a question we're asking. 8778-MY-TAKE. Nominate yours, if you like. MyTakeAtTheTakeaway.org. Go as far back in history as you want, or just use the many, many contemporary examples. So until yesterday, South Carolinians were up at night over the whereabouts of their governor. They had no idea where he was. Yesterday, we learned he'd actually been in Argentina, and he stepped to the podium yesterday afternoon and explained what was going on.
I've been unfaithful to my wife. I developed a relationship with which started as a dear, dear friend from Argentina.
The shockwaves reverberated throughout South Carolina and within the GOP. Joining us now is Mark Quinn, host of South Carolina ETV and Radio's public affairs program, The Big Picture. He joins us from Columbia. Mark, thanks for being with us.
John, it's my pleasure.
I mean, you know, I guess I take a devilish pleasure in these kinds of falls from grace from the state houses. I mean, I remember the Elliott Spitzer case. We had, great interest in the Blagojevich scandal. What's going on in South Carolina as you wake up to this news?
There will be a lot of people in this town and all across this state who have this sort of devilish side of them that, are happy to see this. He didn't have a whole lot of friends in government here, and that sounds strange, you know, because the man it was very popular for a long time with the people out here. But this stimulus battle, which really sucked all the life out of the room in terms of any other debate this spring, really put him in a tough light because, you know, at the end of the day, we were going to pay for that money no matter what. And he was still up there saying, well, we shouldn't take it. But the rest of the people were saying, well, but we're going to have to pay for it. Might as well get it.
Well, Mark, he explicitly referred to his debate over trying to resist taking federal stimulus money and how difficult that was for him when he spoke yesterday. Listen.
I talked about the profound frustrations that I felt over this last legislative session in the battle that was in place with regard to the stimulus package, the $700 million in play. And how at an emotional level, I found it exhausting.
Mark Quinn, is he blaming $700 million for his affair in Argentina?
I don't think he is. I will put it to you like this. If I look at what he's been doing for the last 5 months, just with this battle, a ferocious, hand-to-hand combat battle with the legislature over the stimulus money, and this battle he must have been waging either internally or with his wife at home over this issue of his infidelity, I don't know how he had a chance to keep it all together. I mean, he looked like a broken man yesterday. He did not look like the leader that I was used to seeing for the last 6.5 years.
Comment on the reference you made a moment ago that he didn't have any friends in government at the end, because that was certainly the case for Elliott Spitzer, that whatever you thought about his morals and his judgment, in the end, he was a very lonely fellow when he finally stepped away. And again, there's no indication that Sanford is going to step away, right?
Well, now, right now, I think there's going to be a lot of calls in certain corners for that. He doesn't have a whole lot of support right now from people internally in the GOP saying, okay, he's got to stay no matter what. I will say that, over the last 6.5 years, he's been rather abrasive to the legislators. It's been my way or the highway. There hasn't been a whole lot of constructive dialogue. He's not a good politicker. And that's one of the things I've always just been curious about with him. He doesn't claim to even like government, but yet he has been in government for most of his professional life. But he's not a very good job of going up to somebody, backslapping and say, hey, let's work this out. Not his way.
We talked with a reporter, a woman reporter in the state last hour, and she was saying that on some level, him appearing so vulnerable and broken made it dramatic, not gleeful, and there was nobody really licking their chops over his fall. There was, for some, a sense of real tragedy here.
Absolutely. And if you look on the state.com's newspaper website today, they've listed these very personal private emails that they've exchanged together, that he has written to this woman in Argentina, that she's written back to him. And it sounds and comes off like a cheap Harlequin romance novel, unfortunately. But it really puts it in a whole different light. I honestly think at the end of the day that Governor Sanford's in love with this woman and has really struggled with that, whether that's with his wife and four boys. Yeah, it is a tragedy.
And the shockwaves continuing to reverberate throughout South Carolina and the focus on the headlines out of South Carolina this morning. Mark Quinn, host of South Carolina ETV and Radio's public affairs program, The Big Picture. Thanks for joining us from Columbia, South Carolina.
My pleasure.
And our partners at The New York Times, Gail Collins, a columnist for The New York Times, spoke with us at the top of the hour. Here's a character, Gail, and thanks for staying with us. Here's a character who really is in the middle of a personal tragedy, yet it has very serious implications for the Republican Party, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I don't know that losing Mark Sanford as a possible presidential candidate is all that much of a blow, given the fact that he's a guy who can't apparently emotionally hold up under a battle over the stimulus package. I don't know what he'd do if he had Iran and North Korea and everybody else knocking at his door. But
yikes.
It's bad thinking, All of our possible candidates are falling like flies one after the other.
If he'd gone to Pyongyang, that would have outdone going to RG3. Argentina, I think.
Boy, he'd have been gone for a long time.
Well, let me set up a premise, and you can argue it if you like. We're sort of assembling a Governor's Hall of Fame. Our listeners are nominating people all hour long. But there is a sense, at least around these offices, that there's something going on with governors. Here's a governor you may recognize.
I'm assuming from your answer that you're categorically denying that you ever had an affair with Jennifer Flowers.
I've said that before, and so is she.
Okay, there, of course, Bill Clinton, pre-presidential Bill Clinton. And here's one you may recognize.
There's a lot of media saying that I'm a disgrace for being here. But I'll tell you this. I'm proud I'm a wrestler. I'm proud I was a wrestler. And I'm proud to be here tonight.
So, Gail Collins, I mean, Jesse Ventura didn't get involved in any scandals.
He's sort of well-balanced by the standards that we're talking yes. about today.
But governors are characters in America. You've got even George Wallace, you know, staring down the National Guard on the
Jim
steps.
Jim Folsom and all of those folks down there, especially the southern governors and the populist governors back in the day. You know, the Kirk Fordyce, do you remember Kirk
sure.
Fordyce?
Yeah.
Who vanished on his election night, his re-election night. And then nobody could find him, and he ditched his security. And he wound up in a car crash on the highway, and then later everybody discovered he was out with his girlfriend in Memphis at the time. And that led to kind of a wonderful, if you're into these things, fight about whether the first lady would leave the governor's mansion, and she was refusing to do so, and he was demanding that she go. And he was kicked off as co-chairman of the Dan Quayle for President Committee. It was
there's a big job.
Those were the days.
There's a huge job.
Yeah, that's about as low as you can go. I mean, it's all for the Dan Quayle Committee, guys.
Well, what is it about the governors and the politics in state houses? I mean, it's a huge power in a small domain. Is that the combination that attracts these kinds of characters? And, you know, we could include Sarah Palin in this list. I mean, you know, she's not involved in that kind of scandal, but, you know, is an unusual, eccentric character.
Yeah, you do tend to get people who there's a more wide variety of people than you would often get in legislatures. You know, in legislatures, you get people who at least fancy that they can work together, you know, as in a group. But with governors, it's sort of the opposite. You get these sort of individualists who think that they were meant to lead and who come from all kinds of different backgrounds, and of course, all the states are weird and different anyway. So maybe that's how we get some. Anyway, now you think about it, John Edwards was governor, wasn't he, before he became a senator? Or did he become a senator first?
I don't know. I'll have to check
There's
on that
a lot
one.
Of senators. You're talking so much about governors today. But you got to give the senators a little time too.
Yeah, I think if we spend time researching, this premise sort of begins to fall. But here's one of the issues, and Governor Mark Sanford talked about it yesterday, and we can sort of end on this issue. Take a listen.
It's because what I have found in this job is that one desperately needs a break from the bubble, where in every word, every moment is recorded, just to completely break. And I've found that to be true in trips to the farm or in trips other places further afield.
Now, there's Mark Sanford describing his frustration at being in the public eye. It's sort of the Gary Hart scenario for a senator there, where being in the bubble is a frustration, and it encourages these bad behaviors that result in scandals and bring down the political career.
And that's why I ran for public office. That's because I hated being in the bubble so very, very much.
Yes. Well, there is that. There is that, exactly. So it's all a bunch of malarkey, and you know, that's how your columns always end, Gail. You know, it's like this is what they're saying, but it's all a bunch of malarkey.
We have more important things to do,
and that is true, and that is absolutely true. But you know, thank God for governors. Gail Collins, columnist for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be here.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up, a discussion of some shenanigans that may have happened during the financial bailout. Who are we going to talk to? See if you can guess in just a moment. So it's our Governor's Hall of Fame here on The Takeaway. We want you to give an award for the worst governor of all time. Go as far back in history as you want. You got to compete with Eliot Spitzer, Blagojevich, you know, Mark Sanford now. Nominate any governor from any state you want. Tell us why your pick should win. And what should we name this new award?
I believe what you need to create is the Kennedy Clinton Award for these governors.
Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. So Ben Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve, goes to Capitol Hill today, where Bank of America's acquisition of Merrill Lynch is coming under some very serious scrutiny. The questions have been raised as far back as a few months ago. Here's California Congressman Daryl Issa of the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform speaking yesterday.
What we see is threats being made in private, cover-up of the concerns in order to get the deal done. That's exactly what we don't let the private sector do. We can't tolerate government officials using their power to do.
Bernanke may be asked today by various congressmen about what went on. Did Bank of America receive billions of dollars in federal bailout funds as it struggled to absorb Merrill Lynch's financial liabilities? And was the Federal Reserve pushing to make this deal happen? Peter Morici joins us now. The professor of international business at the University of Maryland. He's in Washington, D.C., a friend of the program. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Let's talk a little bit about these accusations. They're very serious, and Bernanke himself is going to have to answer for them.
Well, Bernanke's in a terribly difficult position. He's a Republican nominee before a Democratic committee, essentially, and there's a lot of angst over the way Merrill Lynch was crammed into Bank of America. But, you know, Ken Lewis deserves much more culpability than Ben Bernanke in all this. I mean,
he's the head of B of A.
Blown the whistle.
He's the head of Bank of America, just to remind
Right, he could have simply blown the whistle and gone public with these pressures if they were really all that great. There is always pressure present when a private company negotiates with a government, because a government has sovereign power and can do all kinds of things. In the case of Ben Bernanke, he's got the line of credit on the banks. So, I mean, he's in a very powerful position to get his way without even making a threat.
So let's just, for the audience who doesn't understand how these deals come down, you know, concoct the scenario here. And you can, you know, whack it with a stick if you like. But I'm thinking, all right, Bank of America basically raised its hand and offered to buy Merrill Lynch as a way of saving Merrill Lynch. The feds said, we can't let Merrill Lynch fail. Bank of America took a look at Merrill Lynch and went to the Fed and said, hey, guys, there's a big mess here. And Bernanke said, forget the mess. We'll bail you out. We'll give you the money. Just make it happen. Is that what the accusation is here?
Essentially, yes. But more than that, they apparently threatened to remove Ken Lewis if he didn't go along.
Wow.
The federal authorities, the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, had it in their heads that if Merrill Lynch failed, it would have the kind of disruptive effects that Lehman Brothers did, and they just felt the system couldn't take it. That they had to save the system, sort of a save the country mentality. At the same time, as we got into these deals, it became more and more obvious there were more problems than anyone could ever calibrate inside of operations like Countrywide or Merrill Lynch or what have you. Remember, this was very uncharted territory. And as a consequence, you know, Bank of America, after being burned at Countrywide, was starting to get cold feet. And they essentially said, you've got to do this. We need you to do this, and we'll back you up. We'll provide financing to do it. Of course, that what does that really mean? It means the government ends up buying the bank and the shareholders take a bath. Ken Lewis really was wrong here. He should have just stood up and said, no, we pay these CEOs massive amounts of money so they can say no, so they can do the right thing. He could have walked away a very wealthy man. He didn't have to hold on to his toy just a little bit longer to now be disgraced.
Well, the thing that's curious there is there was another CEO in the mix, and that was John Thain, the head of Merrill Lynch. It seems to me that the Fed is also complicit in covering up his bad judgments in bringing these horrible losses and bad capital positions to Bank of America in the first place.
This is like the days of pirates in New York City. You know, pirates used to walk the streets of New York City in pre-revolutionary times, and they were kind of heroes. I mean, John Thain is right up there. He basically has buccaneered his way through Wall Street, acquired huge wealth, doled it out to his fellow pirates, his subordinates, and he got to cover up his mess in all this. You're quite right. I mean, John Thain is a despicable individual.
Now, is Bernanke's performance on Capitol Hill today an indication one way or another whether Barack Obama is going to keep him as Fed chairman? If he performs badly, will this be an opening to get rid of him?
This provides the opening he needs. But the reality is he can just get rid of him no matter what happens. This will just make it more difficult to keep him on. Bernanke has done the kinds of things that a conventional wisdom economist like Larry Summers, who's a good mathematician whose policy sense is lacking, likes. He's done the kinds of things the textbooks say you should do. In 1967, as an undergraduate at lowly Plattsburgh State College taking U.S. economic history, I was taught that the Fed caused the Depression or exacerbated it by tightening monetary policy. So it's the mother's milk of economists that Bernanke do what he did, and that is pour lots of liquidity into the system. So, you know, by all rights, he should stay there because he did what they wanted him to do, and he has kind of the right to unwind this mess. But, you know, Obama is such a Chicago ward politician. Everything is patronage with him. I mean, to the point of essentially confiscating, you know, the rights of creditors in the Chrysler deal, that, you know, I think that poor Bernanke is in a very tough position.
Well, we've got to go, but I just wanted to go back to something you said a moment ago. You called Larry Summers a good mathematician. Is that an insult among you economists if you say
well, no, what I'm getting at is in order to make tenure today at a major university such as mine, you have to know a great deal about one thing and be very good at mathematics. We bring them to Washington, and they have a lot of trouble coping with this political reality. I mean, it's no accident that he had the problems he did at Harvard. You don't learn a lot dealing with people or dealing with complex problems in an imperfect world getting tenure in an economics department. What you learn a lot about is convex polyhedrons and T6 space.
Take
and
that.
Maximum likelihood estimators.
Take that, Larry Summers. Peter Morici, professor of international business at the University of Maryland. Thanks, Peter.
Take care.
Now, Richard Hake has the headlines.
And, John, the Labor Department says new jobless claims were up unexpectedly last week. On Capitol Hill today, lawmakers will be trying to find out if Bank of America's purchase of Merrill Lynch happened too fast. House lawmakers are expected to ask that of Fed Chair Ben Bernanke. In Iraq, there have been more deadly bombings today. Iraqi police say one explosion at a Baghdad bus station left 7 people dead, and there were 3 other separate bombings today. That's after a bomb in Baghdad killed more than 60 people yesterday. And staying in the Middle East, there's tight security in Jerusalem for the annual Gay Pride March today. In 2005, 3 participants were stabbed by an ultra-Orthodox Jew, but this year, conservative Jews have said they won't hold protests in order to avoid giving the march greater publicity.
Thank you, Richard. You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry with South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford safely back from Argentina and in flames politically. We wanted to nominate governors for the Worst Governors of All Time Hall of Fame. You can go as far back in history as you want, but you got to compete with, say, Elliot Spitzer. What's your nomination?
I'm Alice Brown from Canton, Massachusetts, and my favorite governor was Jim Folsom, who posed for Life magazine with a mop and a bucket back in the 50s. Said he was going to Montgomery to clean out all the corruption. Well, it would have taken an atom bomb to clean out the corruption in the Alabama Senate and House of Representatives. But at least he says, yes, I'm a crook, but at least I'm honest enough to tell you about it.
Your nominations at 8778-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. So, where were you 25 years ago today?
I never meant to call you when you sorrow. I never meant to call you when you pain.
Hardly seems possible a quarter century ago. The man formerly known as Rogers Nelson, Prince, released Purple Rain, the film and the movie, and it rocketed to the top, changed the 80s forever, and created a new kind of style that really defined the 80s. Purple Rain, what do you think of the album? What was your relationship to it if you were kicking around back in the 80s? Joining us to talk about Purple Rain is Brian Raftery, contributing writer for Spin Magazine. He's in the studio. Good morning, Brian.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's just listen to that Purple Rain for a second and just get suffused with that, Dylan. So what do you make of this album 25 years hence?
Well, it's pretty amazing to listen to it now. I think the conventional wisdom would be that some people still see Prince as an 80s artist, because that was when his main sort of fame was. But it doesn't sound like an 80s record to me when I put it on. I mean, maybe I'm biased because I played it for years and years. But, I mean, what he was doing there by combining rock and synthesizer and R&B, no one's really tried to do that since. And he did it so well and was doing so many different parts of so many different forms of music that it never really sounded outdated. It sounds pretty fresh.
And by the time of Purple Rain, Prince was a well-established artist who grew up in the Twin Cities music scene, which was an incredible scene. Describe that scene that he and a lot of artists came from at a time when, you know, music was dominated by acts in Hollywood and New York.
Well, yeah, I mean, Minneapolis kind of became this focal point. I mean, you had, on one hand, you had Prince and the Time and this really emerging funk rock scene where they're throwing a lot of synthesizers into sort of conventional R&B songs. And on the other hand, at the same time, you had the Replacements and Husker Du on the sort of other side of the musical spectrum. So I don't think a lot of people in the 80s were thinking, boy, I really have to go to Minneapolis to check out the music scene. But after Purple Rain came out, and then once you had the Replacements coming in toward like the mid to late 80s, it became a very, very big musical city.
I actually did a radio story on that scene. It was surprising to me. Prince's gang would go to the Replacements concerts and clubs, and they all knew each other. It was a very tight scene and incredibly creative.
It is, though. It's strange to me still there's never been a sort of a bootleg of like the Replacements and Prince jamming, and that which would have been amazing to hear
that would
at one
be
point.
Amazing. All right, let's hear some other cuts from Purple Rain. Dylan, just cue one up and fire it. You know, there's a range of pop and rock stylings on this record. Describe the diversity that you really hear.
Well, you have everything. I mean, when Doves Cry in a way is kind of a perfect example. It sort of opens with that very psychedelic guitar riff.
Hendrix-like.
Very Hendrix-like. And then the rest of the song has this great sort of staccato dance beat, but it's a number one dance song that doesn't have a bass line, which is amazing. I mean, no one's ever really done that since. And the whole album sort of dips into all these different phases. I mean, there's a Purple Rain, in a way, is almost like a country song. It's just a big, emphatic ballad that could be, you know, you don't need any production on that whatsoever.
Does it remind you, it reminds me of Sgt. Pepper in a sense that it represents this incredibly coherent, creative statement of a band and takes, you know, like Sgt. Pepper did, the Beatles, way beyond these musicians and really creates a kind of style consciousness that Prince really was known for ever since.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And also, you know, as a concept album, it really is telling the story of the movie. I mean, obviously the movie accentuates the, you know, the movie's about Prince playing someone who is not technically Prince, but who sings like Prince, talks like Prince, comes from Prince's same hometown, and is trying to make it in the music scene. And a lot of the songs are just telling that story chronologically through the album. Which is
and there's
cool.
a lot of history. I mean, Darling Nikki was the album, the cut that inspired Tipper Gore to go to Congress and get song lyrics.
I guess she bought the record for her daughter and had no idea that Prince was in any way scandalous, which at that point is kind of amazing to think that she didn't realize that a guy who'd been walking around half naked for the first 3 years of the 80s might put out a record that might not be entirely appropriate for an 11-year-old.
But. Right. What about the success of the movie? It made $80 million.
Yeah.
It's really... It's a dreadful movie in the same way that kind of the Beatles movies were sort of dreadful, but you didn't care. You forgave that because it was a part of the immersion in Prince-ness.
Well, I mean, I never saw it as dreadful. I mean, and again, I had to watch it many, many times recently for the story I did. But, you know, the concert scenes, the concert footage is spectacular. And it opens with those notes from Let's Go Crazy, and he's on stage. And you know, I my wife had never seen it until a couple months ago, and she watched it and got completely entranced. I mean, granted, the love story is a little hokey, but there's some really interesting, weird things in that movie. I mean, Prince is having this very volatile relationship with Apollonia, and, you know, he wasn't a big star. You know, this movie basically was about a jerk. I mean, a guy, a really talented jerk, and for Prince to put himself out there was really risky. Not everyone knew who he was yet.
One sign that this is a really powerful character comes from the Dave Chappelle show. Listen to this. So here's Dave Chappelle playing Prince in a classic basketball scene.
Shoot the J.
Shoot it!
Let's run a play. Computer Blue. Darling Picky.
Prince, we got a towel, man. It's kind of hot out here, man.
Why don't you purify yourself in the waters of Lake Minnetonka? Gay.
Just
blouses.
a towering classic character worthy of parody.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, everyone has stories like that about Prince. I mean, like, you know, it's like after Purple Rain came out, there's a story of one person I interviewed for this piece was talking about how, you know, he wanted to go get his hair cut. And for Prince to get his hair done, it didn't mean just having someone come in. He had to go find a salon, rent it out, black out the windows, have security, make sure no one else is there. And, you know, he's always been Prince. I mean, he's a very eccentric character.
And in many ways, the story of Prince was just beginning. Brian Raftery, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Brian Raftery, contributing writer for Spin Magazine. The current issue has his story about Purple Rain, released 25 years ago today. Album and the movie. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Richard Hake with the headlines.
John, Vice President Biden says more than half of the economic stimulus money set aside for highway projects has been allocated ahead of schedule. That's a $19 billion chunk of money. The top U.S. general in Afghanistan says international troops need to majorly shift how they approach civilian casualties. General Stanley McChrystal says troops must stop firing at insurgents if civilians are present there. And also Attorney General Eric Holder wants to close the gap between prison sentences for crack and powder cocaine crimes.
The sentences are different. Thanks. Thanks, Richard.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. So we've got a little contest going this morning here on The Takeaway. I mean, South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford is in the spotlight, of course, for disappearing for days, admitting to an extramarital affair, actually secretly going down to Argentina to have that affair. But does that make him worst governor of all time?
Hi, it's George Peterson from Huntington, Massachusetts. I do not see what the big deal is about the governor going down to Argentina and having an affair. It's a natural thing, and everybody does it, and I don't think any of them should be apologizing for it.
Natural thing? Well, he's off the hook by that listener. But call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org to nominate your Hall of Shame governor. That's what we're assembling here. And the question is, how do you nominate one? Mark Sanford is certainly in there, okay, the South Carolina governor. But he's competing with some towering figures in governor shame, okay? You've got Rod Blagojevich. You've got Eliot Spitzer. Maybe the one who wins should get an award for corruption.
Hello, this is Marianne from Rhode Island, nominating Edward DePriest of Rhode Island, who not only was sent to jail on corruption charges, then as soon as he got out, there was a long, long battle to claim his state pension. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Kirk, and I'm calling from Boston, and I'd like to nominate Governor Edwards of Louisiana. He was tried three times by the federal government before finally convicted after they were able to sneak a wiretap in his office for numerous crimes.
So you got a couple of categories here, right? You've got the corruption governors, and you've got the marital problem governors. What is it with governors?
Governor Bill Clinton, whose nickname used to be Slick Willie, among other things. And actually, I'd also like to nominate state police in those states who are supposed to be guarding these governors and who look the other way when they're doing all of these extracurricular, extramarital things.
And lest we forget, Nelson Rockefeller, our late governor, actually died in bed with his mistress, his secretary, Megan, I believe was her name. And he also left us with these hideous Rockefeller drug laws, which have been so unfair for years and years and years.
And that continues here in New York. It's kind of a tradition.
Governor Patterson from New York certainly makes the Hall of Fame. He takes a backseat to nobody with this great speech after assuming office in the wake of the Spitzer scandal with drugs and women. And he did it in such a, you know, whatever way.
Sometimes the personality of the governor kind of rubs you the wrong way, you know?
There's a lot of media saying that I'm a disgrace for being here. But I'll tell you this, I'm proud I'm a wrestler, I'm proud I was a wrestler, and I'm proud to be here tonight.
Jesse Ventura, of course, of Minnesota. Sometimes actually what you do as governor is the problem.
Yeah, my name is Eric from Detroit. I was calling to nominate former Republican Governor John Engler for opening the doors to all the mental institutions in Michigan and letting the inmates flood the streets of the inner city.
So Governor Engel, Mark Sanford, who would you nominate? Go to thetakeaway.org or check out all of our coverage on Mark Sanford while you're there. And, of course, you can tweak the kind of award, maybe come up with a name.
You've got it all wrong today. The question should not be what's the matter with governors or what is it about governors, but what is it about men? When was the last time a female governor or a female representative or senator had this problem?
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. We begin this final segment of the morning on The Takeaway with headlines from Richard Hake.
And John, good morning. In Iran, opposition leader Mir Hossein Mousavi is asking protesters to continue opposing the election. On a statement on his website, he says it's their constitutional right. He also says he's holding the people who, quote, rigged the vote responsible for the violence that emerged after the crackdown. Here in the United States, the number of people who filed new jobless claims last week jumped unexpectedly to 627,000. That's a bit of a surprise. Analysts had predicted a drop. Continuing claims rose to more than 6.7 million. Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour is expected to become the next chair for the Republican Governors Association. He'll replace South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, who resigned the post yesterday after admitting he had an affair. President Obama is expected to meet with lawmakers today to talk immigration. It's his first foray into the field, and he wants bipartisan support for any proposal he puts before Congress. David Bowie asked if there was life on Mars, but scientists say it's actually one of Saturn's moons that is most likely to support it. Scientist John Spencer is talking about the moon, Enceladus.
Enceladus is one of the most likely places for life to exist in the solar system beyond the Earth, because we have the three main ingredients that we need for life, which are the basic chemical elements, the basic building blocks, a source of energy, and we now think we have liquid water there as well.
They believe Enceladus has an ocean.
Enceladus.
Enceladus?
That's what he said.
Are you sure?
That's what he said.
I don't know. He had an accent.
He's a scientist.
They believe it has an ocean just like Earth, similar to ours.
Let's go there.
If you want to, let's ride the shuttle.
Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
Health industry groups are expected to deliver...
If you like the plan you have, you can keep it.
To take over the healthcare system, either directly or indirectly, for the government to control it.
A lot of my friends, where they get their healthcare from is the emergency room. They're in the emergency room every week. They break a nail in the emergency room.
How are you going to avoid not having the ability to cost shift as you shrink that portion of privately funded health insurance?
Well, cable news last night was wall-to-wall Mark Sanford, but as you can hear in the music that's been motivating our conversations about health care reform, President Obama last night was at a town meeting on ABC News talking health care reform.
This is not an easy problem. If it was easy, it would have been solved a long time ago, because we've been talking about this for decades, since Harry Truman.
The president really was talking through the kinds of changes and behavioral changes on the part of patients and doctors and legislators and hospitals that are going to happen if real change can take place. It was an interesting exercise in both the psychological hand-holding on the part of the president and policy discussion. And we're joined now by Bernice Pesco-Solido. Pesco-Solido, she's a distinguished professor of sociology at Indiana University, director of the Indiana Consortium for Mental Health Services Research. Bernice, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You know, we wanted to talk with you about the models for health care reform. The town meeting last night was really about tiptoeing towards the edge of a real change, and you could hear a lot of the fear in the questions and even in some of the answers. What do you think are some good models for the kinds of things that have already been suggested in the initial debate in Washington?
Well, I think part of the problem is that people are worried about the wholesale transportation of models from other countries to our country. In fact, in the study that we did, only about 38% of Americans want to see any kind of government intervention in healthcare. And if you compare that with Norway, there was 90%. And I think that this fear is really unfounded, because public the change in the healthcare system really has to be done in the context of our culture.
Right.
And I think Obama understands that. And
well,
I don't.
He said particularly about that statistic you just mentioned, that a lot of people are more comfortable with the devil they have than the devil
that's
they
right.
don't know. Do you think that's a legitimate characterization of how people maybe aren't totally satisfied with the plan they have, but they're much more afraid of what they might get?
Absolutely. In our study, the biggest thing that shaped how people feel about healthcare and healthcare change was the system they grew up in. They're afraid to have a major change in the system that they grew up in.
Even if they're paying more for it?
Yes. And they, in fact, in America, there are only 14% who want to see the government spend more. And I don't really see how we're going to change the system if we don't have some kind of investment. It's not clear to me how Americans think the system can how we're going to fix this without some kind of change, either in spending habits or in how we fund the system.
Now, if we talk about changing habits, that's an argument for mandates and serious regulations that the government would come in and basically set the domain wherein hospitals and patients and doctors can operate. But if you're also talking about other significant changes, like reducing healthcare costs, maybe the mantra there should be get out of the business of a for-profit healthcare system, which would make the United States more like the rest of the world. Do you see a one or the other here, or is it kind of a mishmash?
I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think we're going to see any massive change in the kind of healthcare that we have. But I think one thing that Americans have to do is realize that we're all paying for the uninsured. You know, we have 44 million uninsured. If we don't do anything right now, by 2019, we're going to have 54 million uninsured. And our healthcare premiums reflect having to pay for people who go to the emergency room. They're not getting good care, good or appropriate care at the emergency room for the kind of problems that they bring. And our health premiums, health insurance premiums are going up because of having to keep the system solvent.
How much of the frustration in the debate, and again, it's just getting started in Washington, and we do recall what happened in 1994
yes.
where things totally fell apart. How much of this is less about the fears of consumers and really about the inability of Congress in the 21st century to handle serious social legislation on the order of Social Security, on the order of the enormous changes that took place in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, Civil Rights Act. These are radical changes that it's almost impossible to imagine Congress tackling in our era.
Well, I think that American public policy tends to operate by crisis. And it does seem that at the moment that we really are at a critical point. And I think the reason why Americans are uncomfortable is because we don't know the details. But I think the lesson of the Clinton attempt to change health care was that all the details were worked out in advance, not by Congress, not with response from the people. And so the kind of lack of detail that we see in Obama's plan actually reflects the lesson learned from the failure of the Clinton health care reform.
Well, it's interesting, and he actually referred to that. Listen to the president. He's speaking last night at the town hall meeting on ABC News.
What's lacking is not knowledge. We've been debating this stuff for decades. What's lacking is political will. Genuine change generally does not come from Washington. Whether we like it or not, it comes from the American people saying it's time for us to move forward, and I think this is that moment.
Can serious policy be driven by some American people writing into their congressmen and demanding change?
I don't think so. The health of the history of health care in the United States suggests that it's really the people who organize the health care system. And that doesn't mean just doctors. It does mean politicians. It does mean the state. It does mean the people who finance the system, that they make the changes. But they can only do that in the context of a culture that will support or not support that.
Well, let me hand you a big bucket of stuff that we've talked about over the last few weeks. There's the VA system, which is great on electronic records. There's the Michigan kind of pooling of resources to bulk buy medical services and prescription drugs. There's the Mayo Clinic's disciplined approach to health care and how it reduces costs. And there's lots more I could go into. There's the German regulatory system. There's the Canadian system. Mix or match. What are we going to take as a model here?
We're going to end up with a uniquely American system. It doesn't mean that we can't learn. In fact, I think we know, and I think one of the things we're going to see for sure is that we're going to move toward electronic records. But I think the lesson of one of the lessons of the Massachusetts plan and that experiment,
which is something we also talked about, which was a mandated plan.
That was a mandated plan. And I think that what we see there is that we don't have enough primary care physicians, because specialists are expensive. Primary care can also better integrate the experience of the whole person, but we don't have enough. So it's going to
How do you incentivize that? How do you create an incentive for people to go into primary care and not specialists who get retail cash on the barrel head for most of their services? And it means we have a proliferation of dermatologists and not enough primary care physicians.
Well, I think you incentivize it. And we saw that with when Medicare came in. The AMA was absolutely opposed to it, said that they were going to boycott it. But after the law went in fact, most of them came along. The only ones who didn't were physicians who were close to retirement. So I think if we have a reimbursement plan that requires that there be primary care physicians, we'll see movement in that direction. We also see dramatic change on medical schools and how they're dealing with this. They've created these courses called the New Professionalism, in which they're trying to deal with some of these changes.
Bernice Pesca-Solito, professor of sociology at Indiana University and the director of the Indiana Consortium for Mental Health Services Research, part of our whole conversation on health care reform and the debate that's taking place in Washington. You can go online and see that debate in action, and also join the nominees to our Governor's Hall of Shame. And we want to give an award for the worst governor of all time, so you can go back as far in history as you want and compete with the likes of Rod Blagojevich and some others. Steve in New Boston, Michigan emails, doesn't Louisiana have the permanent corner on the market from Huey Long to Edwin Edwards? Shouldn't we just give the award to Baton Rouge? Roland, listening from Busan, Korea, emails, as a teenager spending a summer in southern Maryland, I was astounded to occasionally see a gentleman alight from what appeared to be an unmarked Maryland State Police vehicle. With a coat over his head, he made his way to the home of an attractive woman named Jean Dorsey. The man turned out to be none other than Governor Honorable Marvin Mandel. Make a nomination at our website. The governors are a rich vein of culture, okay? And happy 25th birthday to Purple Rain. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.